God, THED for INEFOUNDATION 29. Before it is possible to approach deity through philosophy, it is necessary to nullify the traditional practice prevalent throughout Christendom of referring to deity as a masculine potency and ascribing to him most human vices, which, however, become virtues by reason of his unquestioned position as despotic arbiter of right and wrong. The modern religious thinker is no longer inclined to venerate a deity who is simply a highly glorified King George III. In that now vanishing picturesque period of absolute monarchies when fretful and senile princes, arrayed in ridiculous periwigs, ruled by divine right, God was invested with all the propensities of the blood royal, and the celestial hierarchies were metamorphosed into landed gentry. In spite of the repeated emphasis upon our age of enlightenment, the majority of people still continue the age-honored practice of molding God into a likeness of themselves. The reason for this probably lies in the fact that man, possessing a spark of divinity within himself, feels his kinship with God and believes himself privileged to rush in where angels fear to tread, and give definition to the undefinable God being, as Ingersoll so well expressed it, the noblest work of man. We find in the attributes of the God people worship a definite key to their own ethical and philosophic status. It is noticeable that people with puerile intelligences and petty concerns conceive God to be localized as a neighborhood sprite who spends most of his time eavesdropping, and who can afford to ignore universal concerns while he heaps maledictions upon some poor benighted wretch who did not keep his eyes closed during grace. On the other hand, those who have learned to know something of the greater verities of life worship a growing God. This does not presuppose that God is necessarily increasing, but rather that man's increasing capacity to comprehend ever reveals more of the stupendous nature of divinity. As a person approaches a physical object, the object apparently increases in size. The same is true of the mind as it approaches the subject of its consideration. Hence, to the philosopher God extends through the infinitude of time, distance, and thought, and to him it is inconceivable that even for a second deity should 30 lectures on ancient philosophy descend into a state less dignified than the all-inclusiveness of its intrinsic nature. Among many ancient peoples, God was considered as being androgynous, and referred to as the great father-mother. When the Creator was represented by an image, various subtle devices were employed to indicate its hermaphroditic nature. The Istvara of the Hindus is depicted with one side of his body male and the other female. In Greek and Roman statuary, frequent examples are found of a masculine divinity wearing feminine garments and vice versa, or a heavily bearded god may have his hair arranged in a distinctly feminine coiffure. Again, the structure of the face of such deities as Bacchus and Dionysus often shows a sensitive, feminine countenance disguised by a beard or some article of masculine adornment. In other cases, the feminine counterpart of the deity is considered as a separate individuality. For this reason, each of the gods was declared to have had his consort or feminine aspect of his own being. Thus Mithras, the Persian light savior, is considered to be masculine, but a certain portion of himself divided from the rest becomes Mithra, a feminine and maternal potency. As previously noted, in India each god has his Shakti, or feminine part. Among some peoples, deity has been considered for ages as primarily feminine, as the Brahmins who refer to God as the Great Mother. In Roman Catholicism there is also a definite tendency to idealize the feminine principle of God through the person of the Virgin Mary, who is elevated to a most exalted position as Queen of Heaven. The custom of depicting God either as male or female is the outgrowth of man's oldest form of worship, phallicism. Masculine and feminine properties are presumed to be positive and negative respectively. Hence God, being an active or positive agent, was conceived to be masculine, nature, being a passive or negative body, was regarded as feminine in that it received into itself and nurtured to maturity the germinal essences of divine life. The proponents of a masculine God declare that in the beginning was activity, the positive cause of existence. On the other hand, the proponents of the preeminence of the feminine principle declare that activity first issued from a universal matrix. Consequently, that which comes forth from the matrix is subordinate to its own origin. To a certain degree, the Madonna expresses this concept, for the man-child is creation born out of the womb of space, the Holy Mother of ages. To the philosopher, God, as the first manifestation of unmanifested and incomprehensible allness, contains both the potencies of the mother and the father in equilibrium. Material existence is the result of the hypothetical division taking place within the nature of this androgynous deity, from whose higher or masculine nature is created the superphysical universe, and from whose inferior or feminine nature is divided the world of form. From this point of view, God does not act upon an extraneous body, but action and reaction are simply the interaction of the parts of one universal deity. The English language lacks a proper term with which to designate deity. The word God is comparatively meaningless, as it gives no hint of the gender or dignity of divinity other than merely signifying good. Since either a masculine or a feminine term is in appropriate and obviously incomplete, and a neuter term entirely too negative, a word is needed which will express the undivided potencies of both positive and negative in equilibrium. When the terms masculine and feminine were used in philosophic symbolism, the ancients gave a certain supremacy to the masculine principle for two reasons. One, as the male was endowed with greater physical endurance, among primitive peoples, physical strength was considered the most necessary attribute of divinity. Two, as the tribal or state government was a patriarchate, it necessarily followed that God as the supreme ruler became dignified as a masculine entity. Those races, however, which elevated woman to a high social status were more prone to endow deity with distinctive feminine characteristics than were those peoples where woman was regarded as little better than a slave. As time went on, man thus became the personification of the positive principle and woman of the negative. This viewpoint, however, will not bear close fill. 32 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Ossific scrutiny. The so-called inferiority of the female is simply a symbolic figure, having no reference whatever to either the political or ecclesiastical status of woman. It is surprising, however, the extent to which the stigma of this little understood symbolism has influenced both the racial and individual life of woman. It is still not uncommon to meet people who, while they can give no definite explanation for their feelings, are convinced that the feminine organism lacks some peculiar psychical or soul quality which has been reserved exclusively for masculine expression. The popular misconception, presumably promulgated by the Muslims, that heaven was a place accessible to woman as the result of special intercession on the part of her husband, while not publicly taught in Christendom, is never the less painfully evident to those able to analyze accurately the mental and emotional reactions of the average man. Woman's responsibilities as the mother of humanity afford ample evidence to the profound thinker that she is far from being a negative creature. The maternal principle was elevated by the Greeks to first place, and the Mater Deorum, mother of the gods, was esteemed worthy of universal veneration. The relative superiority or inferiority of either the positive or negative principles leads to one inevitable conclusion, namely, that all manifestation being ordered by divine providence, it is impossible to determine intelligently the ultimate impertinence of conditions, each of which is essential to all. God as the Father impregnates space with His seed, God as the Mother receives the seed into herself and protects it through the ages necessary for its unfoldment, and God as the child is Himself the very seed which as God the Father He sowed. Thus is explained the ancient Rosicrucian adage, all is in all. All is all. High commentaries of the Kabbalists upon the early Hebrew scriptures contain lengthy dissertations upon the nature of God as the first being or power to manifest itself upon the surface of En Sof, the limitless and boundless sea of eternal potentiality. According to the Kabbalistic version, there appeared upon and in En Sof a great, gleaming, jewel-encrusted crown. GODTHED4INEFOUNDATION 33. This John Hayden calls the wise man's crown set with suns, moons, and stars and ornamented with archangels. 10 spark. Ling sapphires sent streamers of celestial splendor from their faceted surfaces, and the great crown, Kether, which was the foundation of the world, rested upon the intangible but immovable foundation of the absolute divinity. From the crown issued forth the multitudes of divine and elementary beings who people the 40 spheres comprising the Kabbalistic universe. Thus, to a certain degree, the crown is an ark which, resting upon the hypothetical Ararat of limitless being, the mount of eternity caused to issue from itself by twos and by sevens all that pageantry of life which had been preserved within it through the pralaya, or deluge of cosmic oblivion. Kether, the ancient of ancients, the long face, the opened eye, the holy one, and the Father foundation, enthroned in the midst of being, wills creation and it is. Kether has neither shape nor form imaginable to us, but in an effort to conceive in part its dignity we ascribe to it the noblest forms within the vista of our comprehension. The sphere is the most perfect of all bodies and was therefore chosen by both Pythagoras and Plato as the most perfect symbol of him who shall remain. It is evident, however, that this being does not actually resemble a crown, an opened eye or, as the Kabbalists affirm, a bald head. These figures of speech in no way limit or change the enduring nature of this first power. Whether we call it Father or mother or son, whether WT consider it as androgynous or sexless, human or composite, personal or impersonal, it remains forever itself, the first manifestation of unmanifested power. It was in the beginning, for its appearance marks the term of beginning and end, and time has its inception with the establishment of this first divinity. God is as enduring as time, but time and God are both servants of infinity. The meditation of the mystics upon the nature of the first God revealed to them that deity occupies a position somewhat analogous to a focal point. In God the unknowable potentially ties of absolute existence were concentrated, and through the nature of deity passed down WRD and are distributed as active potencies throughout the negative sphere or field of manifests.